injury with that need to push them and be oppositional at times and not let them kind of rope you into that slow walk. Oh yeah, I support it, but just not this way, etc. You know, how do you balance that?
That's a really fair question, and one we ask ourselves often. And we looked in New York City, who those activists have made some great strides recently with the New York City pension funds actually starting to push back on banks and insurance companies that are funding the fossil fuel crisis. That was a big breakthrough that just happened recently. And those folks have decided to do more direct action and kind of get in people's faces. And believe me, we think about that. Another opportunity when the Treasury says, well, we can't do anything because, you know, there could be a lawsuit. And I always come back with, well, what's to say that we wouldn't go ahead and force some kind of litigation because they are, you know, as far as we can tell, not taking advantage of their opportunity and their direct legal requirement to protect the younger beneficiaries that Rick's, you know, referred to here. So we, you know, we try to use a carrot and a stick as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree that there is that risk of being slow walked. And I think we kind of try to walk that tightrope. Rick has a comment as well, I believe.
Yeah. One thing that we've always done is our homework. We've always made serious attempts to understand how the system really works so we know what the issues really are or are really set.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Camp KBOO is in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is to check out kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Thorgy Thor. I don't get lost. I don't get upset. I just keep doing it, and I really do feel like just doing my show is the largest act of rebellion that you could possibly do when we have standing ovations and we're sold out anyway.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Italian top court recognizes lesbian co-moms of IVF baby. Russian court fines Apple for no promo homo violations. And the drag violin of Thorgy Thor. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm David Hunt.
And I'm Natalie Munoz.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 24th, 2025. A lesbian couple in Italy can both be legally recognized as the mothers of a child they conceived via in vitro fertilization. This thanks to a historic constitutional court ruling. Justices on the country's highest court decided that denying legal recognition to the non-biological mother would be unconstitutional, violating the rights of the child to care, education, and emotional continuity from both parents. Only married heterosexual couples have the right to access medically assisted reproductive services in Italy. Single women and women in same-gender unions must get them abroad. Until now, legal recognition of lesbian co-moms in Italy depended on your location, Some local governments have bucked a 2004 law that bans registering the non-biological mother as a child's co-parent on the birth certificate. That angers far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, whose election campaign included vocal opposition to what she called gender ideologies and the LGBT lobby. To quote the High Court's May 22nd ruling, "These divergent outcomes reflect a shifting social reality to which the legislature has yet to respond." Italy only granted same-gender couples the lesser status of civil unions in 2016. That makes it a prominent exception to marriage equality standards in Europe. Under pressure from the politically powerful Roman Catholic Church, queer couples in civil unions are specifically barred from adopting children. Lesbian mother Chiara Soldatini told Agence France-Presse she would only uncork the champagne when all those families with two dads can toast with me. Champagne time may be in sight, even before the ink on the co-mom's High Court ruling is dry. All surrogacy services are banned in Italy, and non-biological co-dads are prevented from adopting their spouse's children. However, Agence France-Presse reports that a court in Pesaro, northern Italy, has overturned that rule by approving a non-biological gay co-dad's adoption of his spouse's child conceived via surrogacy abroad.
Moscow's Taganski District Court is levying heavy fines on tech giant Apple for violating laws banning the promotion of non-traditional sexual relations. The court charged Apple with three different administrative offenses and a separate charge of failing to restrict users' access to content that is illegal in Russia. More specific information is not available because Apple's lawyers asked that this week's hearings be closed to the public. The fines totaled 10.5 million rubles. That's about $97,000. Russian President Vladimir Putin gleefully signed the 2022 so-called no-promo homo law to cover the entire population with the same ban on the promotion of LGBT propaganda that had applied to minors. Russia's Supreme Court in 2023 declared some mythical international LGBT movement to be extremist. That makes pride celebrations and all public advocacy for queer equality acts of terrorism. Apple has yet to publicly comment.
The same Texas federal judge who tried to ban the abortion pill, mifepristone, now thinks that he can overrule a U.S. Supreme Court decision that banned workplace bias based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Far-right Texas State Attorney General Ken Paxton had challenged guidelines established by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under the Biden administration in 2021. The guidelines were intended to bring EEOC into compliance with the Supreme Court's 2020 anti-bias workplace decision, Bostock v. Clayton. The agency recommended that employers honor their workers' preferred pronouns and allow them to wear dress code appropriate clothing and have access to sex-segregated bathrooms and other facilities that conform to their gender identity. Judge Matthew Kaczmarek of the Northern District of Texas decided this week that those anti-discrimination provisions in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 do not, in fact, protect LGBTQ people. He called the EEOC guidelines inconsistent with the text, history, and tradition of Title VII and recent Supreme Court precedent. The right-wing Judge Schopper's favorite claims that the Bostock decision only forbids discriminatory termination, but that anti-queer harassment and other forms of bias are okay. It's highly unlikely that Kaczmarek's ruling will withstand further legal scrutiny.
Iowa's ban on the discussion of sexual orientation or gender identity in public schools up to the sixth grade can be enforced, but the restrictions can only apply to mandatory classroom education. U.S. District Court Judge Stephen Locker said that schools must allow elective programs on campus that address those subjects. Locker's divided decision allows requiring school officials to out students to their parents, while it approves teachers mentioning their same-gender partners. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds had enthusiastically signed the law passed by the Republican majority in the state legislature.
Thousands of transgender people are set to lose their gender-affirming health care under U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives approved it in the wee hours of the morning this week. It gives the country's wealthiest people major tax breaks on the backs of lower-income citizens who will lose coverage under federal Medicaid and Medicare programs. It particularly prohibits coverage under those programs for all gender-affirming health care nationwide, for adults as well as for minors. Medicaid is a joint federal-state program that offers health care to people with low incomes. It currently serves about 152,000 transgender people, according to the queer think tank Williams Institute. Trump was reportedly on the phone haranguing several wavering Republican Congress members to vote for the bill. In the end, two Republicans joined all Democrats to oppose it, resulting in a slim one-vote majority approval. The bill now goes to the Senate, where a noteworthy number of Republican members have expressed misgivings, either because the cuts to Medicaid and Medicare are too harsh, or because they're not draconian enough. A simple Republican majority may not be enough to pass it in its current form. If the Senate makes any changes, the bill must go back to the House. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says getting the bill to the president's desk by Independence Day, July 4th, is his goal and the aspiration. But the reality is more complicated. There may be time for queer advocates and other opponents to scuttle the worst parts of it.
In Paris, a giant steel star wand lay on the ground in the public gardens near the Bastille Plaza, a new monument to honor the queer victims of the Holocaust. A plaque on the memorial designed by French artist and queer activist Jean-Luc Vernant reads, "Stuck in the ground, this wand is not only magic, like a memory that we would like to bury, a part of forgotten memory. It emerges from the earth to call us to remember. The prerogative of fairies, the starry wand offers a matte black stainless steel side and a mirrored side, evoking the dark hours of history as much as hope and light. Leaning towards visitors, the shadow it casts can appear as a shelter and as a threat that history will repeat itself." The official unveiling was on May 17th, the International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia, or IDAHOBIT. Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo said historical recognition means saying this happened, and we don't want it to happen again. Deputy Mayor of Paris and a longtime LGBTQ plus rights activist, Jean-Luc Romero, echoed that theme. He said, "We didn't know, unfortunately, that this monument would be inaugurated at one of the worst moments we're going through right now. We've never experienced such setback in the United States with what's happening to trans people." Amsterdam, Barcelona, Tel Aviv, and Sydney all have monuments to the queer victims of the Holocaust. While more solid numbers don't exist, many historians believe that from 5 to 15,000 LGBTQ people from across Nazi-occupied Europe were sent to concentration camps during World War II.
Finally, a 55 by 35 foot transgender pride flag was unfurled this week on El Capitan, the famed and challenging wall climbing site in California's Yosemite National Park. Organizers tout it as the largest flag ever hung on the mountain. One of the lead organizers was Patagonia, a well-known drag queen and environmentalist. Their media statement proclaimed in part, "Trans people are natural and trans people are loved. We are done being polite about trans people's existence. Call it a protest, call it a celebration. Either way, it's giving elevation to liberation. Trans existence is not up for debate. We can only make progress when we embrace diversity, not erase it. Let this flag fly higher than hate."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending May 24th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Natalie Munoz. Stay healthy.
And I'm David Hunt. Stay safe.
Hi, this is Terrence Stamp, Bernadette in The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, on This Way Out.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Pride Month is upon us, and fear of the Trump administration has led to many venues canceling LGBTQ plus concerts around the U.S. Drag performances and anything even vaguely associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion are the prime targets for censorship. That's what makes a Los Angeles event featuring a RuPaul's Drag Race favorite special. And This Way Out's Brian DeShazer knows it's special for an even more intriguing reason.
Thor G. Thor, drag queen and superstar, welcome to This Way Out.
I like that superstar. That's good.
We will be talking about drag, believe you me. But I wanted to talk to you first about your love of music and the violin and the upcoming concert at the Hollywood Bowl with the LA Phil called Classical Pride on July 10th. But let's talk about music, because I have a feeling that's where things began before drag sort of interwove with it.
I'll say, I don't know which one was birthed first, but I was a kid with lots of energy and didn't matter where they took me, my family. I was always running around doing cartwheels and backflips, and they couldn't take me to any family function. I went to a museum, MoMA, and I saw a tiger in a Gauguin painting, and I went up to the painting and I went, "Tiger," and it fell off the wall. So, oh yeah. Oh no, we were escorted out. Yeah, at the MoMA. And that wasn't a joke. And I was like, that was me, like, when I was a kid. So, needless to say, my family put me in anything and everything just to get me away. My parents were like, let's put you back in music, because I was playing violin when I was little, but now they were like, we really need to put you into something. And I had private teachers, and, you know, ever since I was 9 or 10, and it kind of just snowballed from there.
But I love the, you know, the violin and the viola. So you have the two instruments playing together, correct?
Well, yeah, my private teacher was smart enough when I was playing violin, and I had a tremendous, very fast growth spurt when I was young, and my R's went, and then, so she goes, you know, we're going to put you on viola, which is a bigger, deeper instrument. And that was actually really genius of her to put me on, because I was very, very good at viola as well. And by the time I got into conservatory for college, I got there and I got in on my audition on violin, but when I got there, they said, you play viola? So they put me in every chamber group, in everything, and I like got a dual degree just because I played so much viola. But, you know, as a freshman in undergrad, I was playing with doctorate majors in, you know, Shostakovich string quartets and stuff. So I was a good violist, I guess. I don't know.
Why is it more rare to find somebody who likes the viola rather than the violin, or is it just a less popular instrument?
And here's the thing. I'm going to watch my mouth what I say, because there's going to be string players listening. And, you know, it's just funny because I've met violists who are some of the best violists I've ever played with, and they started on violin. But then you have all the violists who are like true violists who are very proud to be violists. And I'm like, you know, who cares? But as long as you can play well. But so I'm a violinist transfer. And it doesn't matter, you know. But it is kind of rare to find like a really, really great violist that you love playing with. I'll say that.
So with the upcoming concert at the Hollywood Bowl on July 10th, you're amongst Anthony Roth Costanzo, a great pal of mine, countertenor, Jamie Barton, who I adore. How did you become part of that concert? And just give us a sort of sense of how important it is that an organization like this is doing a classical pride rather than, Diana Ross at the Hollywood Bowl is always pride, but this one is specifically shifting the gaze a little bit, right?
Yes. Yeah, I guess so. You know, it's just an honor to actually be invited to perform in a stage that, I mean, it was like Rolling Stones and the Beatles, you know what I mean? Like, this is like icon, this wonderful place to perform. And, what an honor.
Yeah. So I'm going to bring my own little flavor to it. And it's nice because I love being like the only, I mean, I'm not the only one on the globe, but I'm the only one that I've met so far that's like, hey, let's play together, drag violinist and violist. So I love that I keep being invited. I love it. I love, love, love it. So I'm excited to bring it. And this is just a guest spot at this wonderful show to kind of, what did you say, change the gaze, like that, of what's going on, and to feature a bunch of, you know, queer artists on a stage. You know, it's kind of cool.
Particularly in the classical genre, they're playing, you know, Tchaikovsky and Bernstein.
That's Bernstein. Anyway, so it's a tango, which tangos are always gay to me. But it's very sexy and fun, and I'm going to make it very, very gay, whether they like it or not. And but it's a really, really kind of sexy tango that allows me to really, you know, really play some great violin lines and then also add a little bit of drag humor to it. And, you know, I always say this. Geez, I've said this so many times, but it's true. I go to the orchestra every time and I say, hi, how many of you bought a ticket tonight because you saw me on television? Are you like drag? You know, you watch drag, right? And it's usually about half the audience going, yeah. And then I say, all right, shush. How many of you are season ticket holders to the symphony and you have no idea what the hell you're doing here? And it's about the other half. And everyone laughs. And I go, listen, this is what has become my small responsibility in this classical and queer world at this point in time, is that I'm being afforded this lovely opportunity to come out here and do this. And look to your left and to your right. You know, there's queer kids, there's trans kids, and there's like older married straight couples with money, and they're donating to the symphony. And I said, "You, this might be a concert that you're sitting next to somebody that you might never sit next to them at any other type of concert. So let's just agree to have a good time tonight." And I said, I hope that some of the drag lovers tonight come back to the symphony, buy a ticket and support your local symphony, even though I'm not here. And vice versa, I want to see some of the older folks at the nightclub supporting their drag performers at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Monday night going, yes.
Yes, exactly. In fact, I was going to ask you when the blend of the violin and your drag happened, because what you just expressed is the flowering and just the explosion of that ball of energy that you have, and the energy that comes through music and the energy that comes through drag.
Yeah.
And I'm just excited that you're the one that found it out.
And it's fine. I create. Yeah, you're right. Thank you very much. I created music and drag. We heard it here. I created it. I flowered it. Thank you for that. No, but I was just always a crazy kid. And I knew when I got older and was developing sexuality and like really learning more about myself as a musician and as a queer kid, I was like, oh, where do I fit? What do I do? You know, and it was tough because I was really studying music very seriously. I went to college for that. And I hadn't done drag before my first year at college. But as soon as I got there, you know, I caught the drag bug through Rocky Horror. I was Frankenfurter at Rocky Horror. And I was like, oh, this is for life now. You know, like, this is great. What else can we do? You know, every day my brain would be like, oh, this is a great medium. This is a great discipline of craft and queerness, because it's so much fun. You use your body as your medium. And, you know, I talk a lot, if you haven't noticed. I talk a lot no matter where I go. And that is just my power, that I'm just like ready to go all the time. And I found that when I was dressed up in this glamorous armor and I was 9 feet tall, people listened. And I was like, this is great, you know? And also I play violin, you know? So, you know, I really had to push it down. A lot of people laughed at me. And I'll say this, a lot of people in the drag community, when I moved into Brooklyn, I hit the ground running. I was performing everywhere 20 plus years ago, you know? A lot of people were like, what? Classical music? That doesn't belong here in nightclubs. You know, a lot of people were like, what? It's not cool. And I was like, but I think it's cool. So I decided to make it effing cool. And I think it is cool what I do. I just had to convince people along the way. Now, vice versa, when I did my first orchestra, or when I kept going to the orchestras, you know, I would be following Renee Fleming the weekend before, or Thierry Takanawa, or Itzhak Perlman, Hilary Hahn, and then it would be like Thorgy and the Thor Orchestra, and you would get these players that are some of the best in the world, and you walk into, you know, Toronto Symphony Orchestra. They're the amazing players, top of the, you know, and people look you up and down, you know, and they're like, who, what? So all, you know, string players are judgmental, We have no patience. And by the way, I sat usually concertmaster, most of these orchestras, doing the same thing, like, oh God, who's this now? But then you roll with it. But because they're perfectionists, string players are perfectionists. They don't like to waste time. When I got out there, I was like, my hardest thing was convincing all the players to enjoy what I was doing there, to relax a little bit, have more fun. And then I would make that joke and say, I know Hilary Hahn couldn't make it tonight, but you got me, you know, or something, you know, stupid. And they would like, I'd be like, all right, I'm getting some of you on board. And after we did the show and I was in, you know, full glamour and after the show and we did all these things because it's a variety show. My Thor Jeans Orchestra is a big variety show. I paint pictures. I play a lot. I do soliloquy with, you know, Mozart in the background. It's really, it's funny, but it's beautiful, the symphonic music. And afterwards, I have all these players, some of them very conservative, come up to me and go, can I tell you something? I go, what? And they're like, this is the most fun I have ever had playing in the symphony, and I've been part of it for 19 years.
So about drag, let's get to the drag. You know, some of my question, how on earth do you do all the outfits all the time? Do you design yourself? Do you have a team? That seems like a full-time job alone, never mind the violin and the whole touring and the business, but I can barely get ready for this interview. Look what I'm wearing.
Well, thank you. So here's the thing. Oh, God, that's a convoluted question. I could go on and on. Yes, you know what? I wear certain things for certain gigs. If the budget's higher, I have more money to work with to hire a designer. You know, I can sew, and I can make things that fit my body quickly if I need a new one of those, you know? But if I'm going to tailor a beautiful suit, I'm not tailoring a beautiful, you know, to get everything impeccable, I hire a designer. And I do have many different designers that I work with. If one of them's busy, I'll switch back and forth. Also, different designers charge different amounts. So, you know, or certain designers take a lot longer to produce things than other ones. So you have to be careful who you ask. But I like putting things on rotation. And you touched on something that I was going to say is the expectation to always show up in something new. Every single time you're being photographed is insanity.
What? I didn't rate it.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous. Well, I understand if I'm going to film a new season of Drag Race, I will go back and I'm not going to pull things that I've worn before that have makeup stains on the collar, okay? But, you know, when I do gigs and it's the same kind of gig, I'm like, for instance, playing violin. If you look just at the physicality of doing this, you know, and you're mic'd, right? So you can't wear certain hair. No glue here because you have mic sets and my arms need to be this. So there is nothing, if you watch, like there's nothing really constricting my shoulders. It gets very, very warm. No floor length gowns that I'm going to trip on because I move around a lot and I'm holding a violin with both hands. So, and I've learned that no jewelry. I can't wear any jewelry because the clicking and clacking gets picked up by the microphones. Mm-hmm. So little things you learn along the way where, you know, sound people, because I'm like, please just let me keep this earring on, please. And they're like, it just, you can hear it. And I'm like, all right. So it sucks. People are like, oh, she's not wearing any earrings. I'm like, all right, you know, sorry. You know, I don't know what to say. But things like that. So different outfits, different costumes. Also, Hollywood Bowl, isn't that outside?
Yes.
I'm really into royal blue right now. I don't know why. I go
through. That could work if it's a little glimmery.
Okay. Never black.
No.
I want to do a gown. The thing is with me, you call me a ball of energy. Physically, I'm lucky enough that my brain and my body can keep up with my brain still. But I move a lot. And when I'm playing and moving and I go to this side of the stage and that side of the stage, I like doing that. High kicks. I like bringing that energy. A gown is so restrictive to me. I'm like, oh, I don't know. I'm probably going to get canceled for this, but I don't care. No, so I was in the works, I mean, a year ago or whatever, with a Florida Symphony Orchestra. But because of everything going on with our administration and the bands, they called me and they said, yeah, we're going to have to put this show and this contract on the back burner. And I went, what? And, you know, I was a little, like, I didn't know what was going on. And then I quickly was like frustrated and I looked it up and I talked to a lot of people and I went, oh my God, I'm like one of those performances. And whether or not you like it, most of these large symphony orchestras are funded by very religious, conservative people that come from money and their foundations. I really just feel like I'm me.
And my show is really, really interesting, amazing, funny, a little bit different, a little quirky, with beautiful music and cheeky humor. And I happen to be a man in a dress.
Does it shock you that you've got that reaction, or that you're the victim, I guess, of this kind of legislation?
I think it takes a lot to shock me. I really just keep going. I don't get lost. I don't get upset. I just keep doing it. And I really do feel like just doing my show is the largest act of rebellion that you could possibly do when we have standing ovations and we're sold out anyway. And then I can convince some of the conservative members of the orchestra to be like, this was the best. I'm like, I know. I know.
It's been such a pleasure to talk to you and get to know you. I do want to come backstage at the Hollywood Bowl, give you a nice big cuddle. Turn it out at the Hollywood Bowl on July 10th.
And who knows, maybe Grace Jones will show up. Maybe I can borrow her dress.
For This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by David Hunt and Natalie Munoz and produced by Brian DeShazer, who was also this week's feature correspondent. You heard music from Camelot and Somewhere performed by Thorgi Thor. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks John Beaupre of Los Angeles, California, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WMPG Portland, Maine, KMUN Astoria, Oregon, GSA Pretoria, South Africa, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Queery. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
She's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Queery, every third Saturday at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And I lose control, think I follow
home. In 2021, I wrote a feature for the New York Times about what I thought would be the death of gay restaurants.
Author Eric Piepenberg.
I was so wrong. I love gay restaurants. I remember gay restaurants. I still go to gay restaurants. So I think for my first book, I'm going to write a book about gay restaurants, which is, as far as I know, still no one's ever written. To me, a gay restaurant is a restaurant where when I open the door, I look around and I see my people.
Happy Pride, and welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Dozens of Europarliament members plan to defy the Budapest Pride ban. UK trans women can now be strip searched by male cops. And a unique history of queer people meeting and eating. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Ava Davis.
And I'm Marcos Najera.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 31st, 2025. More than 70 members of the European Parliament plan to defy a ban on Budapest Pride. They're heeding the call of Pride organizers for international allies, activists, and friends to support their standoff against Hungary's autocratic Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, according to CNN. Orbán's compliant parliament approved his constitutional amendment earlier this year, outlawing all LGBTQ pride events, ostensibly in the name of child protection. Budapest police say they'll use facial recognition software to identify and fine everyone who attends the June 28th parade. 20 of Hungary's fellow European Union member nations condemned the anti-queer legislation in a letter this week. Foreign ministries including Austria, Belgium, the Czech Republic, France, Germany, Ireland, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden said the European Commission should expeditiously make full use of the rule of law toolbox at its disposal if the Pride ban is not lifted. The letter reads in part, "Respecting and protecting the human rights and fundamental freedoms of all people, including LGBTIQ plus persons, is inherent in being part of the European family. This is our responsibility and shared commitment of the member states and the European institutions." Orbán has been at odds with the EU for years now. He's turned his nose up at significant EU funding that's been withheld because of the Eastern European countries' escalating anti-democratic, anti-queer, and racist anti-immigrant laws.
Transgender women suspects in the UK can now be strip-searched by male cops. The National Police Chiefs Council issued its interim guidance to every police force on May 22nd in keeping with the Supreme Court ruling that trans women are not legal women under the 2010 Equality Act. The NPCC guidance says the ruling makes clear that thorough police searches, such as those which expose intimate body parts, should be carried out by police officers and staff of the same biological sex as the detained person. The guidelines extend to transgender officers and prison staff. Very limited exceptions may be allowed if someone asks to be searched by a police officer in their affirmed gender. The guidance demands that any search not conducted in line with biological sex must have the written consent of the detainee, the officer carrying out the search, as well as the authorizing officer. NPCC Chair Chief Constable Gavin Stevens posted on the group's website, "We understand the depth of feeling there is on these issues, both among transgender communities as well as those who hold gender-critical views. Policing remains committed to treating everyone with fairness, dignity, and respect." The April 16th UK High Court ruling was the result of a case filed by the gender-critical group For Women Scotland. They sued the Scottish government for a policy declaration that trans women were considered women on government boards that require equal male-female membership. Angry protests over the continued degradation of transgender rights have erupted in Edinburgh and London, according to qnews.com.au. One group of trans women stood topless outside the Scottish Parliament following its decision to weave the Supreme Court's ruling into federal policy. Lawmakers decided that the use of all sex-specific facilities in the building must now be based on a person's birth gender. Hundreds of protesters marched from Marby Arch to Downing Street in London, organized by the activist group Strive, standing for trans rights, inclusion, and visibility everywhere. Demonstrators were invited to remove their tops, and several waved trans flags defiantly bare-chested at the gates of Number 10.
The asylum case of gay Venezuelan makeup artist Andre Hernandez Romero has been dismissed by an immigration judge in San Diego, California. As far as his attorneys know, he's languishing in El Salvador's infamous maximum security CICOT prison, remanded there in March without warning by the Trump administration. They have not been able to confirm his whereabouts, communicate with him, or determine his current physical and mental condition. Hernandez Romero's asylum claim was based on the persecution he endured for being queer and expressing progressive political beliefs in Venezuela. He had complied with all aspects of the process and was waiting for his hearing at San Diego's Otay Mesa Detention Center, according to the Immigration Defenders Law Center. He's now the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit filed in March by the American Civil Liberties Union, Democracy Ford, and the ACLU of D.C., demanding the return of all the men shipped off to CICOT without due process. Close to 200 Venezuelans have gone to CICOT in the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign against what the president has called terrorists. Like others, Hernandez Romero has tattoos that supposedly prove his membership in the notorious Tren de Aragua gang. His lawyers say that the gay man's tattoos represent nothing of the sort. U.S. immigration judges work for the Department of Justice and are not part of the independent federal judiciary. Hernandez Romero supporters worry that a Justice Department politicized under Trump will never give him a fair hearing. The dismissal of his asylum case robs Hernandez Romero of a key link to the U.S. system of due process. This week's ruling means he can apply again, but only if he returns to the U.S., according to NBC News. Of course, that's impossible under the circumstances. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has rebuffed requests for intervention from openly gay U.S. Congressman from California, Robert Garcia, and other sympathetic lawmakers.
In better queer immigration news, a district judge is ordering that a gay Guatemalan man be returned to the U.S. The man, identified only by the initials OCG, was seeking asylum because of the anti-queer violence he had suffered at home. He was presumably protected under an immigration order issued last year, but the Trump administration suddenly sent OCG to Mexico, where he had been raped and held for ransom on his journey to the U.S. He was returned to Guatemala 2 months ago. Since then, he said in a declaration to the court, "I have been living in hiding, in constant panic and constant fear." U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy said the deportation lacked any semblance of due process. In Murphy's words, "No one has ever suggested that OCG poses any sort of security threat. In general, this case presents no special facts or legal circumstances, only the banal horror of a man being wrongfully loaded onto a bus and sent back to a country where he was allegedly just raped and kidnapped. Whether the Trump administration obeys the ruling remains to be seen."
Finally, for an anti-woke schedule that's supposed to be free of drag, the 2025-2026 season at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts will still feature plenty of men in dresses. President Donald Trump's all-caps rant on his Feeble Truth social platform screamed, "No more drag shows or other anti-American propaganda," when he announced in February that he had fired the board and installed himself as chair. Gay sycophant Rick Grinnell was named as the head of the nation's Washington, D.C. showplace. Trump declared, "Just last year, the Kennedy Center featured drag shows specifically targeting our youth. This will stop." Maybe it escaped the reality TV star's notice, or maybe it's just a classic Trumpian reversal of policy, but here's a taste of the upcoming Kennedy Center season.
"Guys, I need you to make me a woman."
"What?"
"Miranda is hiring a nanny, and I put myself up for the job as a woman, and I have an interview tomorrow."
"What?"
"Guys, please, I'm begging you. Make me a woman. Give it a shot. Come on and give me the best that you've got."
The hit Broadway musical, Mrs. Doubtfire, tells the story of a father posing as a female nanny to spend more time with his children after a divorce. That's not all. The Kennedy Center will also host Monty Python's Spamalot, with men dressed as women in prominent scenes. Moulin Rouge will be performed, including a drag queen character named Baby Doll. Someone will take the role of Chicago's Mama Morton, made famous by queer icon Queen Latifah and drag queen Jinx Monsoon. Chicago character Mary Sunshine is revealed to be male in one of the show's most memorable scenes. So, maybe just a few more drag shows, Mr. President.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending May 31st, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Are you what you eat? What, where, and with whom to eat have been defining traits of the community as queer people have found love, friendship, and fellowship, be it over patty melts, pizza, or lobster thermidor. That rich history is served up by Eric Piepenberg in his new book, Dining Out. This Way Out's David Hunt lays out a feast from Piepenberg's culinary journey to show how tastes and taste buds have changed.
No portrait of America's culinary history or queer past is complete without memories of LGBTQ+ restaurants, where moments, big and small, helped shape individuals and communities. So writes journalist Eric Piepenberg in his first book, titled Dining Out, First Dates, Defiant Nights, and Last Call Disco Fries at America's Gay Restaurants, published by Grand Central Publishing. It's a history book, a travelogue, a coming out story, but most of all, a good read about the mostly good food served up to generations of hungry queer folk across the United States. How did dining influence gay lifestyles of yesteryear? What's the state of queer dining today? And what makes a gay restaurant gay, anyway? Those questions and more are on the menu as I sit down to chew the fat with author Eric Piepenberg. In Armistead Maupin's 1978 novel, Tales of the City, Cleveland, Ohio transplant Mary Ann Singleton arrives in San Francisco, eager to immerse herself in the vibrant and decidedly alternative culture of one of America's gay capital cities. "I'm starved," she announces, speaking no doubt for many a wide-eyed refugee from the heartland, gay and straight. I'm David Hunt. Eric Piepenberg followed that trajectory a decade later, leaving his Rust Belt hometown to live, work, and love in some of the nation's great gay metros, New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. If he was starving for a taste of gay life, he would find it, in his words, in all kinds of restaurants, from cozy family-run taquerias and working-class pubs to tiny dive bars and James Beard award-winning bistros. Piepenberg worried for a time that he was witnessing the end of an era.
In 2021, I wrote a feature for the New York Times about what I thought would be the death of gay restaurants. I came out and came of age as a gay man in the 90s. I lived in Chicago, in D.C., in New York, and on a Friday night in D.C., for example, on 17th Street, you could just go from gay restaurant to gay restaurant to gay restaurant to gay restaurant. And that's the same in many other gay neighborhoods across the country. But I hadn't seen that much in New York, where I live now. And I thought, well, gay restaurants aren't a thing anymore. I was so wrong. After I started talking to people and did some reporting on the piece, I realized that gay restaurants are not what they were in New York, but in other parts of the country, they are absolutely thriving. So I had so much material left over from this New York Times feature that I thought, well, you know what? I love gay restaurants. I remember gay restaurants. I still go to gay restaurants. So I think for my first book, I'm going to write a book about gay restaurants, which is, as far as I know, still no one's ever written. And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to be the guy to write that book.
Piepenberg's journalistic journey became a literary journey, a journey that wound its way across the United States and across generations. To read Dining Out is to join Piepenberg on a trek that takes you from Walt Whitman's weekly lunches with his bohemian pals at Pfaff's Saloon in New York in the mid-19th century, to drag brunch at Hamburger Mary's in disco-era San Francisco, where regulars included then-Mayor Dianne Feinstein, from Annie's Paramount Steakhouse in Washington, D.C., arguably the oldest gay restaurant in the nation, renowned for its hefty steaks and strong cocktails, to Bloodroot in Bridgeport, Connecticut, a feminist salon and bookstore with no cash registers, no wait staff, and a seasonal vegetarian menu. The book includes chapters on trend-setting restaurants like Lucky Chang's in New York City, cruisy clubs like Gallus in Atlanta, and trans-friendly eateries like the Napoli's Lounge and Grill in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Dining Out explores the role of gay restaurants in the fight for queer equality and in the response to the AIDS epidemic, and the book takes a fresh look at queer resistance in the pre-Stonewall era, at places like Cooper's Donuts in Los Angeles and Compton's Cafeteria in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. I asked Piepenberg how he researched the rich history of gay dining, from automats to bathhouse barbecues, greasy spoons to Michelin star hotspots.
I went to archives across the country and cities that I visited and just sort of like looked around at the gay press, if there was a gay newspaper, because usually what you'd find are ads. Newspapers from the 70s and 80s, certainly, that would be filled with ads from gay restaurants saying, come to our buffet or our brunch, what have you. But for earlier places like the automat in the 30s, there's a lot of information out there about automats generally. But it makes sense when I sort of dug a little deeper into the automats that, yeah, it was open to everyone. You could come in. If you had a dime, you'd put a dime in the slot, you get a piece of pie and a cup of coffee for 5 cents, and you could sit there. And if one thing, I'll speak for gay men, they're good at is sort of scoping out the right place to be to find each other. And I think the automat is an early example of the kind of place that was queer. They wouldn't have called it then, but it was the kind of place that there's lots and lots of out there about automats, but not so much about how gay men sort of took it over and said, we're not going to be flashy about it. We're not going to make a big scene about it. But if I'm on one side of the automat and I lock eyes with somebody, if I cruise somebody else on the other side of the restaurant, that's a gay experience in this otherwise straight environment. And there were a lot of examples of that, of other restaurants and other types of restaurants that gay people sort of made their own under the radar of anyone else who was there. To me, a gay restaurant is a restaurant where when I open the door, I look around and I see my people.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. Journalist Eric Piepenberg calls himself a diner gay, a Gen Xer who came of age in the 1980s and 90s, when meeting up often involved hash browns, not hashtags.
I have a whole chapter on diners because I think people underestimate the extent to which diners, usually because of hours and location, are gay restaurants. But you can be 13-year-old who's just come out of the closet and you can go to a gay restaurant. You can't do that at a gay bar. You could be a gay elder who doesn't want to go to the bars with the music and the expensive drinks, and they just want to sit there and with their other elder friends, and they know you there, they know how you like your food. And so I think one of the things that you'll find often in a lot of these places is that the whole community, in terms of age, in terms of interests and types, generally can go there and be welcome, which is something that you don't necessarily find at gay bars.
What you do find at many diners is an enduring gay trope, the sassy, foul-mouthed waitress with a heart of gold. At the Silver Grill in Atlanta for 5 decades, beginning in 1958, that waitress was Peggy Hubbard. Piepenberg says the waitress, who died in 2010, was a mother figure for her gay customers. Well, motherly in a Joan Crawford kind of way.
you know the type. She had just like the bouffant, the thick eyeshadow, no nonsense. If it's busy, I don't have time for you. Just tell me what you want, and I'll put your order in. But she was also very present at AIDS fundraisers. She was also very much, you know, the gay guys were her boys, and she integrated them into her life, which wasn't always the case. I think there are a lot of waitresses who are just like, that's my job and I go home. But Peggy was so beloved by the gay community and by drag queens and people who worked there and ate there that she sort of became part of that world.
The Silver Grill, where she waited tables, was a legendary establishment, spawning a 1975 song, The Silver Grill Blues, by drag artist Diamond Lil.
So when he asked me my name, I said, you can call me Lil. And furthermore, sweet baby, you can always find me hanging around this old Silver Grill.
And a 1997 country music show called Della's Diner 6, written by Tom Edwards, described by critics as Mayberry meets Melrose Place. Sadly, the Silver Grill closed in 2006. Another gay restaurant that obtained legendary status is still going strong. The servers are just as sassy as Peggy Hubbard, with a difference.
Lucky Chang's was a restaurant that opened in the early 90s in East Village in New York, and it sort of set itself apart because the servers and the people who worked there were all, in the first year, for sure, were all Asian drag queens and Asian trans women who worked in a drag context. And that had kind of never really been done exactly quite like that before. It got very popular very fast, and it made an appearance on Sex and the City, and celebrities would go there, rich Wall Street guys. It was the hot downtown hotspot to be.
After crisscrossing the country on a quest to document the history and current state of dining in the LGBTQ community, what did Piepenburg learn? Is the gay restaurant scene fading, or is it still a foundational experience in queer life?
I think the state of LGBTQ dining is really, really strong, and I think it is more diverse than ever. Does it look like what I remember back in the 90s? Mostly no. But it's so much broader and so much different, and I think so much more queer. I think that's the thing that sort of surprised me the most, is that restaurants that are queer are, the food has queerness in them. The people who work there are trans and non-binary and just much more open about what it means to be LGBTQ and sort of define sexuality and gender in ways that I think have never really been done before.
Researching and writing Dining Out was a profound experience for Piepenburg, an opportunity to celebrate the people and places that shaped the LGBTQ movement and his own personal journey as a gay man.
I'm 54, and when I think of nostalgia, I think of, oh, what it was like to be in my 20s and go to these restaurants and, you know, flirt and listen to music and maybe, you know, meet someone in the bathroom, or, you know, just the things that you take for granted when you're in your 20s. And I think if I was in therapy, my therapist would probably say that I'm looking back on my life now and sort of understanding what it was like to be at a time when gay restaurants were thriving, now that they're really not, at least in New York, in the way that I remember them. And so I think I've learned about how fun it is that gay restaurants are sort of how they have evolved and changed. But also, I have a new respect for the gay restaurants that were open way before I was even alive, and the ways that which gay people have for decades found each other through meals.
There's more, a lot more, in Eric Piepenburg's new book, Dining Out. If you have a favorite gay restaurant, past or present, you may just find it among the book's 300 or so pages. Are you a fan of Casita del Campo in Los Angeles? Do you remember The Florent, an all-night diner in Manhattan's meatpacking district? Are you a regular at Lazy's Kitchen in Salt Lake City? Wherever you do your LGBTQ dining, fine or otherwise, you're part of a great gay tradition. As Piepenburg writes, recounting a youthful experience at the Melrose in Chicago, a bad date, a satisfying meal. the promise of sex. That's what happens, or used to happen, at gay restaurants. I'd like to thank Eric Piepenberg for talking with me for this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Ava Davis and Marcos Najera and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. You heard music from Mrs. Doubtfire the Musical, Simon and Garfunkel, from the musical Oliver, and by Avis and Diamond Lil. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Lee Sloan of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Trappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening. Online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KZAX, Bellingham, Washington, 2RRR, Gladesville, New South Wales, WRFZ, Rochester, New York, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1930.